This is Sophia Rifkin-Haas reading from Marisha Pessl's Special Topics in Calamity Physics, pages 98 to 100. We usually sat down for dinner around 5:30. Hannah turned off the lights, the music, Nat King Cole demanding to be flown to the moon, Peggy Lee sermonizing, "You're nobody till somebody loves you," lighting the thin red candles at the center of the table. Dinner conversation wasn't anything Dad would be particularly impressed with. No debates about Castro, Pol Pot, and the Khmer Rouge, though sometimes she brought up materialism. It's hard in America not to equate happiness with things. But Hannah, chin in her hand, eyes dark as caves, was a master of the art of listening. And thus dinners could last 2-3 hours, maybe even longer, if I hadn't been the one who had to get home by 8.
"Too much Joyce isn't good for you," Dad said. "Bad for digestion."
To describe this singular quality of hers, which I believe holds one of the brightest lanterns to her sometimes shadowy profile, is impossible, because what she did had nothing to do with words. It was just this way about her, and the wasn't premeditated, condescending, or forced. See chapter 9, get your teen to consider you in the in crowd. Befriending Your Kids, Howard's 2000. Obviously, being able to simply was a skill supremely underestimated in the Western world. As Dad was fond of pointing out, in America, apart from those who won the lottery, generally all winners were in possession of a strident voice, which was successfully used to overpower the thrum of all the competing voices, thereby producing a country that was insanely loud, so loud most of the time, no actual meaning could be discerned, only nationwide white noise. And thus, when you met someone who listened, someone content to do nothing but... So overwhelming was the difference. You had the startling and quite lonely epiphany that everyone else, every person you'd encountered since the day you were born, who'd supposedly listened, had not really been listening to you at all. They'd been subtly checking out their own reflection in the glass bureau a little to the west of your head, thinking what they had to do later that evening, or deciding that next, as soon as you shut up, they were going to tell that classic story about their bout of Bangladeshi beachside dysentery, thereby showcasing how worldly, how wild, not to mention how utterly enviable a human being they were. Hannah did ultimately speak, of course, but it wasn't to tell you what she thought or what you had to do, but only to ask you certain relevant questions, which were often laughable in their simplicity. One, I remember, was, "Well, what do you think?" Afterward, when Charles cleared the plates, Lana and Turner jumped onto her lap, fashioning her arm bracelets out of their tails, and Jay turned on the music, Mel Torme detailing how you were getting to be a habit with him. You didn't feel the edgy feeling of being alone in the world. As stupid as this sounds, you felt you had an answer. It was this quality, I think, that made her have such an influence on the others. She was the reason Jade, for example, who sometimes talked of becoming a journalist, joined the Galway Gazette as a freelance writer, even though she downright loathed Hilary Leach, the editor-in-chief who pulled out a copy of The New Yorker and read it before every class, sometimes chuckling irritatingly at something in Talk of the Town. And Charles sometimes carried around a 3-inch textbook, How to Be a Hitchcock Learner, 1999, which I secretly paged through one Sunday and beheld the first page inscription, "To my master of suspense, love, Hannah." Lula tutored fourth graders in science every Tuesday after school at Elmview Elementary. Nigel read the definitive Foreign Service Exam Study Guide, 2001 edition, and Milton had taken an acting class at the UNCS the previous summer. Introduction to Shakespeare, The Art of the Body. Acts of humanitarianism and self-improvement, I couldn't help but think, had originally been Hannah's suggestions, though proposed in her way, they probably believed they'd thought of it themselves. I, too, was not immune to her brand of inspiration. At the beginning of October, Hannah arranged with Evita for me to drop out of AP French with drapery drab Miss Philobeck and enroll with a bunch of freshmen in beginning drawing, with the dolly decadent Mr. Victor Motes. I did so without breathing a word to Dad. Motes was Hannah's favorite teacher at Galway. "I absolutely adore Victor," she said, biting her bottom lip. "He's wonderful. Nigel's in one of his classes. Isn't he wonderful? I think he's wonderful. Really." And Victor was wonderful. Victor sported faux suede shirts in permanent magenta and burnt sienna, and had hair that, under the art room lights, channeled the gleam of film noir streets, Humphrey Bogart's wingtips, opera footlights and tar all at the same time. Hannah also bought me a sketchbook and 5 ink pens, which she wrapped in old-fashioned parcel paper and sent to my school mailbox. She never talked about things. She simply did them. On the inside cover, she'd written, in a handwriting that was a perfect extension of her, elegant with tiny mysteries in the curves of her N's and H's, "For your blue period, Hannah." In the middle of class, occasionally, I'd take the thing out and covertly try to draw something, like Mr. Archer's rain-a-day hands. Though I showed no signs of being an untapped El Greco, I enjoyed pretending I was a rheumatoid artiste, some Toulouse concentrating on the outline of bony arm of a can-can girl, instead of plain old blue Van Meer, who might go down in history for the talent of feverishly copying down every syllable a teacher uttered, including ums and ehs, in case it showed up on the unit test.